Us and Them is sponsored by the Charleston Gazette-Mail, the largest newspaper in the state of West Virginia, featuring two editorial pages expressing both progressive and conservative views. Find it online at wvgazettemail.com. And if you are interested in advertising on this podcast, send us an email at advertising@usandthempodcast.com. About 12 years ago in a smoky Manhattan East Village rock club, I discovered the leisure class, which was like sitting in the stands of a debauched circus. Hey, this is Trey Kay. That's me several years ago when I was doing a story for NPR about this band that I liked in the 1990s. They were called the Leisure Class.
I saw beauty in a
The band had a first-class horn section, a small choir of backing vocalists, and perhaps most captivating was frontman Dimitri Mucianis, a possessed madman from Detroit who would strut and jump around the stage, cussing and freely launching into poetic rants.
Zach sat on a rock of the same name. He berated an electrician by trade who was moonstruck and born of flame. They called him Red.
This guy Dimitri fascinated me. Back in the 90s, he seemed like the archetypal, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side, New York artist. He was handsome, charismatic, and edgy as all get out.
My heroes, a lot of them were in the beat movement, you know, and it was Hunky, it was Burroughs, Corso, Ginsberg. Well, I got to meet these guys, you know. I got to cop dope for these guys. I got to live with these guys, you know.
His name is Antoine.
They call him Tony.
He come from Haiti.
He speaks the Creole.
I got to know Dimitri because I used to play in the New York clubs, too, with my band, the Cheesebeads. And it turned out Dimitri had a dark side. I remember one time back in the 90s, I was a part of this gig that featured the Leisure Class, Dimitri's band. And at the end of the night, I had this envelope that was filled with the band's cut of the money that was collected at the door. I was waiting to give it to them when my friend Rita came over and said, "Trey, whatever you do, don't give any money to Dimitri. You gotta know, he's a junkie. If you give him any money, he's gonna go smoke that crack crack."
When he smoked that crack,
crack, that's all I know, that's all I know.
He go to heaven,
that's all I know.
From West Virginia Public Broadcasting, this is Us and Them, the podcast where we tell stories about America's cultural divides. Today, we're talking about heroin. At the end of the last episode, I spoke about an upsurge in heroin use. It's a big deal. Even conservative presidential candidates are talking about it.
The problem of heroin in New Hampshire is unbelievable. It's like an unbelievable problem that you have.
This is a problem that, for me, I understand firsthand. My older sister, Miriam, who was my half-sister, struggled her whole life with drug and alcohol addiction.
And notice how there's kind of a sympathy here, as though addicts were people just like you and me. Us, not them. We're going to devote this episode and our next show to heroin. In today's show, I reconnect with Dimitri, 12 years after Rita told me not to give him any money. It happened like this. I was walking through New York's East Village. I ran into Dan, a guy who played guitar with the Leisure Class. We caught up on what we've been doing over the years. And I asked, whatever happened to Dimitri? Is he still alive? I mean, I assumed that he might be dead. Dan said, no, he's still with us, and he's off heroin. And as a matter of fact, he has kind of an amazing story for how he kicked. So I called Dimitri, and he told me his story, and it was kind of amazing. I called my audio producer friend, Lou Olkowski, and we decided to pitch it to This American Life. So I'm going to play you the piece that we produced back in 2006. And then you're going to probably wonder what happened to Dimitri. So I'm going to tell you that strange story, too. Here's This American Life host, Ira Glass.
Act two, I'm not a doctor, but I play one at the Holiday Inn. Back in the 60s, a heavy drug user, a hippie, named Howard Lotsoff, tried a powerful hallucinogen named Ibogaine. Lotsoff apparently had one of the most intense drug experiences of his life. And when it was done, the odd thing was he had absolutely no desire to ever use drugs again. Just wasn't interested. He stayed clean. And years later, he decided that Ibogaine should be used to cure drug addicts. And so he tested and got patents for several different dosages of Ibogaine. But for a variety of reasons, it never got picked up by any of your mainstream drug companies. But Ibogaine hung around on the margins. This drug that could supposedly do the impossible, especially for heroin addicts. You take it, go on this intense trip, and at the end of that trip, you have no withdrawal symptoms. None. Nothing. And you also have no desire to ever do heroin again. Well, this brings us to our story, which was put together by Lou Olkowski and Trey Kay. Lou narrates.
At his worst, Dmitri was living in his parents' basement in Detroit. He'd been using heroin for 27 years. His wife had died, many of his friends had died, and he was edging towards 40. That was when it finally hit him that it was time to do something. In 2002, Dmitri went to Amsterdam for an experimental Ibogaine treatment. It was given to him by a woman who cared for drug users out of her thatched roof farmhouse, surrounded by her 5 kids. 30 hours after taking the drug, Dmitri was cured of his heroin addiction, literally cured of his 27-year-old habit. He remembers waking up at the crack of dawn 3 days later and experiencing a sensation that he hadn't felt in years. Joy.
I have never felt that good in my life. Didn't need heroin. I was completely exhausted. And I was just, I just kept on saying, praise God over and over and over again. And one of the little girls, I can't remember which daughter it was, she said, we had a black man from the Bronx and he kept saying the same thing. You know, praise God, man, praise God.
Dmitri says a lot of people come out of Ibogaine treatments feeling euphoric, almost evangelical. And Dmitri became a kind of Ibogaine convert, determined to take the good news about this miracle drug that had instantly cured him to other junkies. He knew tons of people back in the States that needed help, and as far as Dmitri was concerned, they weren't treated well by the traditional medical establishment.
I mean, my girlfriend works in a hospital. She comes back and tells me these stories, and I've seen it. I've been in a hospital when I was an active user and fought with doctors for friends of mine. I had a friend of mine sent home with spinal meningitis and aspirin because they didn't believe it. And he turned out to be HIV positive too. And, you know, I took him in a second time and I got in a big fight with this doctor who started moralizing, you know. So, you know, God only gives you 3 chances, you know. Not only is he an MD, but he knows how many chances God gives you.
And so Dmitri decided to become an Ibogaine provider himself, to save his friends just like the woman in Amsterdam had saved him. There were only 2 problems with this otherwise laudable goal. First of all, because Ibogaine is a hallucinogen, it's illegal in the U.S. It's a Schedule I drug, like heroin, and if Dmitri was caught buying or selling Ibogaine, he could go to prison for the rest of his life. The second problem was that by giving people Ibogaine, Dmitri was basically doing the job of a doctor or nurse without being either. Dmitri was a small-time rock star, bike messenger, dishwasher. He hadn't even taken a first aid course, and Ibogaine is a potentially dangerous psychotropic. So for guidance, Dmitri hooked up with other underground Ibogaine providers, former junkies like Dmitri, who over several decades had developed a kind of ad hoc collection of protocols about dosage and care. And the first time he gave a treatment, it went okay. But with the second guy, a drug dealer who helped Dmitri find Ibogaine and who actually referred addicts to him for treatment, it didn't go so smoothly.
So we go through the process. He gets done with it, basically. Okay, this is my second treatment. And then he goes into a seizure, you know, eyes rolling back his head, foaming at the mouth, biting his tongue. A seizure was unbelievable. I thought he was dead. Long story short, I was freaked. And actually, at that point, I panicked. I didn't know what to do. This guy's going to die. And what the hell am I doing? You know, and this guy's going to die. And, yeah, what business do I have to do this?
Dmitri managed to get the guy to a hospital, where he eventually recovered. But this was the first time Dmitri realized exactly what he'd gotten himself into. How crazy it was to be flying without a net, doing a job that put other people's lives into his hands. And this is the issue. Dimitri knows what it's like to be a junkie, to be desperate, frantic, to quit. And he believes that since he has what he thinks is a cure, despite the risk, it's his moral responsibility, his obligation, really, to help.
It's terrifying, man. You know, and especially, you spend time with these people, you get to know people. God, you don't want them to die. You don't want them to be hurt in any way.
Because Dimitri doesn't want his clients to be hurt in any way, he tries to be as much like a professional clinic as a former junkie with a by-the-seat-of-your-pants operation can be. He says he's even cobbled together a set of rules, more or less through trial and error. For example, clients should be clean of drugs and alcohol for a certain amount of time before a treatment. They should get EKGs if possible, and liver panels. And so just like he's had to invent nearly everything else about this job, he's had to invent boundaries for himself. Boundaries that are hard to maintain with everyone.
They ring my doorbell, call me up, and I had a guy threatening to shoot me 2 weeks ago who went on a relapse, and this is like a real close guy, man. He wanted to kill me.
Having a client threaten to shoot you probably wouldn't be accepted in the world of professional medicine. But Dimitri sees addicts differently than most people do. He loves them. I interviewed him for a total of 35 hours over 7 months, and here's how he described every single addict he knows.
He's a brilliant guy. He's a beautiful guy. He's a great guy. He's a musician. He's a writer. He's an incredibly sweet man. He's such a great guy. He's got great taste in music. He's read some great books. He's funny. He's strange. I like him, man. I really like him.
One of the people Dimitri talks about this way, one of his clients, is Jimmy. Jimmy's middle-aged, clean-cut, working class, the kind of guy you'd see working at the post office or sitting next to you on a bus. He's clearly, genuinely a sweet guy. But if you hang around with him long enough, you feel the dark cloud that follows him around. I talked to Jimmy a few days before Dimitri was going to give him an Ibogaine treatment, and he told me he'd tried to shake heroin many times before. He'd done traditional rehab and a whole array of alternative treatments. He even tried Ibogaine once before with another underground provider. According to Jimmy, Ibogaine pretty much worked the first time around. He says after the treatment, he felt no craving for heroin. The thing that made him relapse was the dark cloud. All the other problems in his life.
Somewhere around 3 or 4 months when I started feeling a little bit lonely again, and, you know, it's like, why isn't anything really happening? I mean, I'm feeling all these feelings, but what's really changing in my life? You know? I remember Eric was talking about a guy had taken Ibogaine, and a few months later he met a girl, he got married, and, you know, so I'm like, well, when is this going to happen for me? It's like, and then I started getting to feel like, you know, maybe I'm just the same old person, you know, and there is no cure, you know.
See where this knucklehead is?
I'm standing on a street corner in the rain in midtown Manhattan with Dimitri. It's 5 p.m., the time Jimmy's supposed to show for his treatment, but he's late. Dimitri is not happy. Just the week before, he was waiting for a client in the exact same spot, and the guy never showed. It's not unusual. The flake factor is an occupational hazard when your entire client base is heroin addicts. But it still gets to Dimitri, who's always nervous and tense before treatment.
I'm getting hives, which is normal. See? It's all over my legs and my feet. I get hives every treatment.
Finally, 3 hours later, 3 hours, Jimmy arrives.
There he is. He is Jimmy! Jimmy!
We drive up and open the car door for Jimmy.
Get the in the car!
Sorry for putting you through all that crap, but...
What, did you forget that you're going to take a, like, stronger African hallucinogen today, so I slipped your mind?
Yeah, I just crashed because I was like up all night.
Okay. Well, at least you got some sleep.
And then Dimitri begins the underground provider equivalent of an intake survey.
You been hydrating yourself today?
Yeah, sorta.
When's the last time you used?
Thursday.
What time?
7, maybe 8.
Okay. How many bags were you doing at the end?
You know, it really depended on how much money I had. I tried to hold a bundle for the whole week, and I ended up doing the whole bundle in one day. You know, so, I mean, So I can't hold on to it. That sucks.
As I listen to this exchange, it's hard to tell if Dimitri is getting any useful information. It's also casual. Basically, Dimitri and Jimmy just joke around until we get to the hotel in New Jersey, a comfortable chain where Dimitri has instructed Jimmy to book an economy suite with a small bedroom and a separate living space with cable TV. While Jimmy hangs out, Dimitri puts away some groceries and preps the room.
We're set up a bucket for him to puke in. We want to make the room as dark as possible. Good thing it's starting at night.
Dimitri is careful to make everything as comfortable as possible for Jimmy. He even turns around the LCD alarm clock because he knows people are really sensitive to light when they're on Ibogaine. Then he takes out about 20 capsules containing varying amounts of Ibogaine. He lays the pills on the desk and tries to figure out how much to give Jimmy.
All right. What am I doing? Do about a 16. That's too much.
Can you say what you're doing?
I want to give my desk a dose of like 16 milligrams per kilogram. I'm just trying to combine the pills so they add up to that. Yep, that's right. Okay. You ready, buddy?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay.
Jimmy strips down to his underpants and crawls into bed before taking the dose. His job is to lay there, as still as possible, in this dark room and let the drug take effect. Dimitri's job is to wait on the other side of the door in case anything goes wrong. After 2 hours, Dimitri goes in to check on his patient. Jimmy doesn't acknowledge we're there until Dimitri asks how he's doing. He opens his eyes and looks around, but just like a newborn baby, his eyes don't really focus on anything.
It's really intense.
It's really intense?
Yeah.
Okay. You throw up a little bit?
Huh?
Did you throw up a little bit?
Yeah.
You're doing fine, though, bro. You're doing really good. Do you want to get a towel for you?
Huh?
You want a towel?
No.
Okay, buddy. Okay.
The treatment takes about 30 hours and is, at least for Dimitri and me, uneventful. We watch a lot of TV. Dimitri checks in on Jimmy and cleans him up when he throws up. Jimmy just lies there having visions. Not sleeping, but not fully coherent either. Dimitri seems worried when Jimmy's finished with the treatment. Jimmy isn't euphoric the way people usually are. Instead, he's kind of depressed and agitated. And after chatting a little bit, Jimmy reveals that he'd been doing coke the night before.
I was getting high the night before, coke and all,
you know. Oh, you did coke the night before?
Yeah. I was smoking crack.
Ah, smoking crack. All right, let me tell you something. Don't smoke crack the night before.
Actually, Friday, when you called me up, I was smoking crack. When you called me, you asked me where I was.
At 5 o'clock?
Yeah.
Now remember that when we picked Jimmy up, he told Dimitri he'd been clean since Thursday, the day before the treatment.
So you were smoking crack all night?
Yeah.
So you didn't get any sleep?
No, I was smoking crack all from
Thursday.
So
really, basically you haven't slept since Thursday morning, it's Sunday evening.
Right.
So you had kind of had that crack Ibogaine combo a little bit.
And not only that, I was doing benzos and methadone too.
Oh, really? For how long?
About 2 weeks.
Anything else, man? Right now it doesn't really matter. Just for my amusement.
No.
Okay. you like sniffing shoe polish or anything like that? No. No, no blue. Okay.
Dimitri was joking, but later when I talked to him, he copped to the fact that mixing all those drugs was a really bad idea. Something horrible could have happened.
And so the risk would be like heart attack?
I don't know. Be honest with you, I don't know. And I just, maybe I should know that, but I don't.
When I went home, I called the doctor who does Ibogaine treatments at a licensed clinic in Cancun, Mexico. He told me that because Jimmy had taken benzodiazepine, there was a serious risk of seizure and potentially death. Which brings us back to Dimitri's constant dilemma. He knows he's doing a really risky job. He can't control everything, and the stakes are very high. And when I raise this with him, he suddenly seems sad.
I probably don't have a lot of business doing it in a certain sense, you know? But there's nobody else doing it.
And that, it seems, is the heart of it. No one else is doing it. So far, everything's worked out okay for Dimitri. No one has been killed or hurt on his watch. In fact, he feels he's helped many people. And he likes doing this work.
The actual work is basically touching people, cleaning people, nurturing people, holding people up, soothing their fears, being stern when they need someone some direction, you know, during the actual, you know, and being really patient and quiet. Yeah, it's not about, it really does, it's not about me.
The job is to love these people, he says. But sometimes that's really hard. There are just so many addicts with so many problems.
Okay, this guy's got a probation officer, and he needs to do this, this, and this, but he doesn't have a house, and this other guy's homeless too, and she's got like all these abandonment issues, and then this one can't really get it because to get off the psych meds, you know, would be too much, and on and on and on. You know, all these people with really sad, hard lives. And I struggle, you know, I think about, like, you know, what am I really doing? How important is it? You know, and I think about that a lot. But like I said, I think I've said this many times. This is what I can do, okay? This little thing, you know, this little thing.
Dimitri just hopes doing that one little thing is enough.
Lou Wachowski, she reported the story with Trey Kay.
That was I'm Not a Doctor, But I Play One at the Holiday Inn. Lou Wachowski and I produced this piece for This American Life back in 2006. You might be wondering if Dimitri risked getting arrested by letting us put his story on the radio. I mean, there he was, using his real name, publicly announcing that he was regularly committing felonies. We don't think the story led the police to Dimitri, but they eventually caught up with him anyway. More about that after the break. I'm Trey Kay, and this is Us and Them, which is supported in part by the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. Hey, as you know, this show is made possible by the good people at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. And I'd like to crow about some of the other good work that they do. Do you know about Inside Appalachia? It's a radio show and also a podcast that focuses on the issues of people living in the swath of America that starts up north in western New York and Pennsylvania and Ohio and goes down to Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, with Maryland and West Virginia sandwiched in between. Each week, my colleagues Jessica Lilly and Roxy Todd take listeners on an audio tour through this region rich with history and culture. A recent episode piqued my interest because it was particularly us-y and them-y. Did you hear news last summer about gun stores throughout the nation refusing to sell guns to Muslims? Inside Appalachia's Roxy Todd visited the tiny town of Whitesburg, Kentucky, where back in the summer of 2015, one shop put up a blinking electronic sign.
The sign said, Muslim-free gun store. Photos of the sign traveled all over the country. So did the words of the gun store's co-owner, Jill Stidham.
Islam is a religion of hate, and they are bringing hate upon our country every day.
We're losing more and more of our freedom every day. We used to live in a free country. I don't feel like we live in a free country anymore. As far as I know, I have the freedom of speech, and that's no more than freedom of speech.
But other people in Whitesburg had freedom of speech too. And Roxy tells the story of what happened next.
The day after the anti-Muslim sign went up, a different type of sign began appearing all over Whitesburg.
And they were yellow, just regular yellow sheets of paper that read, this business welcomes everyone, or this organization welcomes everyone.
That's Inside Appalachia. If you'd like to hear more or subscribe to their podcast, go to wvpublic.org. And over on our website, usandthempodcast.com, you'll find all of our shows, including Femme Voice, a story about a male-to-female transsexual who found that looking like a woman is really hard work, but sounding like one is even harder. Find that and more at usandthempodcast.com. Several weeks ago, I went up to Spanish Harlem in New York City to visit with my friend Dimitri. I met him outside, and we walked up three or four flights of stairs to his tiny studio apartment.
Yeah, welcome to my little place, man.
I sat in one of the few chairs that Dmitri could fit into the room, and he sat on the edge of his bed. I asked him what he'd been up to these days. Oh, and you might have noticed that the This American Life producers bleeped Dmitri's colorful language in the piece that they broadcast on the radio. As a heads up, in this following interview, we've suspended the bleep fest on Dmitri's comments and left everything just as he said it.
My name's Dmitri Majanis, and I work with primarily drug users, but in harm reduction. It's my sort of my day job. I'm like Naganga, which is a spiritual healer in residence at New York Harm Reduction Educators in East Harlem. I also work with plant medicines, particularly Ibogaine in a shamanistic tradition known as Bwiti.
Bwiti is a spiritual discipline practiced by the people of Gabon and Cameroon. Part of the practice of Bwiti is to ingest the root bark of the Tabernath Iboga plant, which is basically the powerful Ibogaine drug that you heard about in the This American Life piece. Since Lou and I produced our story, Dmitri has gone to Gabon and got initiated in the practices of the Bwiti. Now he is an Nganga, or a Bwiti priest.
I work with all kinds of people, but mainly with people who are struggling with addiction.
We're here in your apartment in Spanish Harlem. It's a studio apartment. I smell incense in here. All around his place, he has these little shrines and altars for various kinds of worship. And I see all kinds of things, gong and pots and candles and looks like a sage smudge pot and various other things that to me look like it has to do with some type of spiritual practice. Can you just tell me what it is I'm looking at? And candles at the door, too.
Well, there's basically four different altars here. So there's a Palo Moembe altar, which is a Afro-Caribbean-based religion. Right by the door, I have an Ogun, which was made for me by my teacher who was an Ifa. There's two shrines right there. That is my Bwiti. That is the basket which I was initiated with. This, what we have over here, is the stuff I use for my sound work. It's a little bit, I was going to try to straighten it up because it's a little bit cluttered, but I have Tibetan singing bowls and gongs and a Shruti box and several other instruments. I use all this in sound meditation and sound healing and also shamanistic healing. So I work with private clients in here as well.
In the piece that we did for This American Life years ago, another thing that we brought out in the piece was this whole idea that you have deep love for people who have substance addiction, and particularly heroin addicts. Why is this?
I think that the best people I've ever met are drug users or so-called addicts or problematic drug users, whether in recovery or out of recovery. And I think there might be something about the sensitivity of people who are in this lifestyle. I also like transgression. I think a transgressive quality is a rebellious quality, perhaps a revolutionary quality. So I like that. I love drug users. They're my people. They're my people. They're people I feel comfortable with. The wit, you know, the street wit. It's sad, man. I hear sad stories, but I laugh my ass off every day. These are very funny, witty people.
The guy that we featured in the This American Life piece, Jimmy, how's he doing now?
I haven't talked to Jimmy in a couple years. Wow. Jimmy struggled. The last time I knew he was off of drugs, but, you know, dealing with some very serious issues, including, you know, homelessness. And this is off of drugs, you know. So I haven't seen him in a while. Last time I saw him, because there's a film that came out. I don't know if you're at the premiere of the film.
Dmitri is referring to a film called I'm Dangerous with Love. It's by documentarian Michelle Negroponte. And it's about Dmitri's work using Ibogaine to help heroin addicts.
It's chaos. It involves crime. It involves elements of death. You know, physical danger. I fucking love it. And I will continue. I don't, you know, so it's this element of chaos that's always been in my life. Things are going good. I want to mix it up.
Anyway, the last time Dimitri saw Jimmy was when he showed up for the premiere of the documentary.
He came walking in late, busted in past security, even though it was sold out, wearing like a long headscarf and telling everyone that he was in this fucking movie. They dragged him out. And I thought, okay, you know, I talked to him after that. It was cool. He apologized. I think, you know, he has some issues.
Did he relapse?
I think, he relapsed a few times, but we treated him again. And I can't really remember how that ended in terms of our involvement. He did some crazy stuff. He did some crazy stuff.
Speaking of crazy stuff, I always thought Dimitri was a little crazy being so public about doing his Ibogaine treatments in the U.S. When Lou and I did our story, there was a website for people looking to get Ibogaine treatments, and Dimitri's contact information was listed. He would speak at public forums advocating for Ibogaine, and of course, lots of people knew him from our This American Life segment and Michelle Negroponte's film. Dimitri's story was also featured on Vice, the documentary program on HBO.
Okay. Was Ibogaine illegal at this time?
Ibogaine has been illegal since Nixon.
Ibogaine was made illegal in 1969 at the height of the hippie movement. And today, lives right alongside heroin as a Schedule I drug. And although it's legal in most countries, Ibogaine has some of the stiffest legal penalties here in America. So if you want to use it to get off...
In 2011, Dimitri's good luck wore thin.
A couple years back, I was arrested in a DEA sting in Seattle. We were about to administer a treatment. They used an addict, a drug user, a paid informant. And that was about a two-year ordeal. It cost a lot of money, so I had to stop doing my work.
So basically, Dimitri told me that the prosecution was really trying to throw the book at him and some of his Ibogaine treatment partners. They were looking at some serious prison time. They got this prominent old lion of a lawyer, Tony Serra, for their defense. I mean, this guy helped Black Panther Huey Newton walk from a murder charge. So anyway, the defense asserted on behalf of Dimitri and company that the use of Ibogaine was part of their religion, their Wheaties religion. And the judge agreed.
He said a few things that were absolutely mind-blowing. He said he didn't know what Wheaties was, but he didn't have to know what Wheaties was. It doesn't matter that it was clearly our religion.
So in the end, he sentenced them to 45 days house arrest.
You know, so I had to be home for 45. I got grounded. I got grounded by the feds, you know, and I had to be home like every day, at 10 o'clock or something. But when I went to the probation, they didn't have seen something like that. So it was really extraordinary in so many ways. And let me say this first. The main reason that I'm sitting here without a felony conviction, and there's no doubt in my mind of this, is because of my gender, because of my color, and because of my access to cultural capital. The amount of people that came out in support of us was amazing, from doctors to, you know, homeless people who we had worked with. And the story I want to tell about is the guy that was before us in the court. It was an African-American man, I guess in his 50s. Here's this man, and he met with his attorney, this woman who was clearly meeting him for the first time. I was watching this, completely rushed. I'm sure this woman was overwhelmed, doing the best she could, fumbling through papers. They're talking in the hallway, and I'm watching this. He goes up. It makes me angry to talk about. So he goes up, and they go to the judge, and basically says, you know, they say, well, you know, he's had 7 urine test, and 2 of them came up positive for cocaine. Now, as somebody who works in harm reduction, works with drug addiction, I'm thinking, wow, this guy had 4 fucking clean urines. Amazing, right? Because he was on some drug charges. He was working and paying child support. And he relapsed, as folks who have issues would. And the judge said, I don't want to have to send you to jail, and then sent him back to jail. So that's the drug war.
Or at least that used to be the drug war. And in some ways it still is, but the drug war is changing. In our next episode, we're going to hear about a kinder, gentler approach to treating drug addicts. And we'll hear how Dimitri feels about this. We'll also speak with a law professor about how law enforcement is prosecuting the drug war these days, and how the perception of the heroin problem changes when there are more white addicts than black ones.
Sometimes it's as heartbreaking as a mother at a funeral telling people, I want you to know that my child was addicted, and having a whole community say, that could be our child too. Whereas if you remember, the response during the mid-80s and 90s was to shame addicts, right? Parents had to whisper that their child died of addiction. Nobody wanted to talk about it because, of course, this was a sign of weakness either in your child, in your family, or in your community.
That's what we'll cover next time. But until then, we want to hear from you. As we've been preparing these episodes, I'm just amazed by the stories that are coming out of the woodwork. It seems that heroin and opioid addiction isn't just something that's happening to a them far away from our lives. I was just having dinner the other night with a friend who asked me what the next episode was about. And I said heroin. And then he proceeded to tell me about his daughter, who has been a heroin addict for about 6 years. I mean, I know this guy pretty well, and I had no idea. So, what are your stories? Do you have someone in your life struggling with an addiction to heroin or prescription opioids or some other substance? And what do you think of Dimitri's work with Ibogaine to help people kick their habit? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter at UsThemPodcast or through our feedback page at usandthempodcast.com. And remember, there's no ampersand. You've been listening to Us and Them. The show was produced by Mitch Hanley, Lori Stern, and me, Trey Kay, and was edited by Catherine Winter. The This American Life segment was produced by me and Lou Okowski and was edited by Nancy Updike, Elise Spiegel, and Ira Glass. And while I'm thanking the people from This American Life, like a knucklehead, I neglected to thank many of the good people from that show who played a big part in helping us produce our previous Femme Voice episode. Special thanks to Brian Reed and Joel Lovell for the editing help, and to Matt Tierney for the technical support. I'm most grateful to everyone from that wonderful program. Michael Lipton and Tristan Lozow performed the Us and Them theme music. Mark Lerner designed our logo. Rita Krasoffi and Mariana Trofimova designed our website at usandthempodcast.com and provide us with images for the web. Our intern is Sophia Tedesco. And special thanks to our transcriber, Sherry Seegers, for making it through my interview with Dimitri. That dude speaks with great passion, but does so at a lightning-fast pace. Thanks, Sherry, for getting all of that down. The fantastic people at West Virginia Public Broadcasting make Us and Them possible. So do grants from the West Virginia Humanities Council, the CRC Foundation, and the Daywood Foundation. I make myself a blank slate. I wash my brain out, make it clean. I wash my brain out, make it clean. Dimitri Mujanis currently works as an outreach counselor for New York Harm Reduction Educators in Harlem. And taking us out today is some music from Dimitri's band, The Leisure Class. I really do think that they were exceptional. If you want to know more about that band or get some of their recordings, we've posted some info on our website at usandthempodcast.com. Yes, I'm ready to receive Jesus. I'm ready. Ready to receive. I think I'm ready to receive the terrible, 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 terrible Jehovah. Yes, I'm ready. Ready to receive. And I think I'm ready to open up to Buddha. And in about 2.5 weeks, we'll hope that you'll be ready to receive some more Us and Them. Come on, give it to me, baby.